You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today, in recognition of our Labor Day holiday weekend, which I hope everybody's enjoying, my guest is going to talk about the state of the American worker and other issues impacting our labor force here in the United States. He's Robert Bruno, the director of the Labor Education Program and a professor of labor and employment relations at the University of Illinois Champaign. I just checked back. I had Bob on my show the first year I started. It doesn't seem that long. Bob, it's been too long. Welcome back.
Yes, it has been too long, and it's a pleasure to be back with you, particularly to celebrate such an important national holiday.
Yeah, I think we take this weekend for granted of all our holidays, and it's unfortunate. But I wanted to kind of just this is a broad question, but we'll kind of take parts of it and dissect along the way here. But what is broadly speaking, generally speaking, what's the state of the American worker during here Labor Day 2021?
It's a state of, I think, uncertainty, duress, and yet there is a subtle, shift in the amount of leverage that workers have. Obviously, we're emerging from a very deep recession, so there's a great demand for workers. And we're also still confronting a very serious public health crisis. And the two combined, I think, have put many workers, certainly those that are not able to work in remote settings, in more difficult and challenging work environments. But also because of the great demand to open up our economy and to find labor, there is a shifting in the market power that workers have, and you can see workers actually being more selective on jobs that they choose to have, and we're seeing a important, if somewhat small, increase in the hourly wage for the vast majority of production workers. And the additional stress caused by working during a public health crisis, I think has also created added incentives for workers to think about organizing into labor unions as a way of protecting their health and safety. It's a bit of a mixed bag, I think. But the demand for work for workers is strong, which is good for workers. And at the same time, I think workers are still looking for the right institutions, the right forms in order to better leverage the moment so that they can find, if you will, higher quality jobs than was true in our economy before the onset of the COVID pandemic in the spring of 2020.
It certainly seemed to change our perception of essential workers. I remember during COVID looking at a lot of the grocery store clerks and all that were working masked up. And, of course, people that work in healthcare. Of course, COVID, how long this lasts and all. There are some who say we're going to have to live with this quite mm-hmm. a while. And that's going to have some enormous impact on the labor market, I would assume, going forward.
So there's, you know, there's lots of uncertainty about what, you know, what kind of safety mitigations will be needed and for how long as one variant of the COVID virus gives way to another. But it's incumbent upon the employer and the government to create safe working conditions. And given, you know, that you cannot do the vast majority of these hourly wage jobs without a lot of people, right? And you need them in the workplace. So you can't replace them all with technology. And they can't do all of these work, all of this work at home remotely. That means that you're going to have to, the employer and the government really are going to have to confront the need to create safer workplaces. And whatever those measures are, that is going to, you know, that's an investment that the employer is going to have to make. And best way, I think, to figure out how to create safe work environments is to work collaboratively with your workforce, right? And to and actually present a workplace that is safe and present a workplace that gives to an individual an opportunity to do meaningful work. And so that's probably going to mean you're also going to have to raise what you pay those workers. You're probably going to have to put more money into some sort of benefit package. You're going to have to do some more professional development so those workers acquire new skills, continue to develop skills. In other words, there's an opportunity here to, in the midst of what are really trying and uncertain times, there's a way to think about a future of work in which we're looking at higher quality jobs that actually provide people ladders into the middle class. So yes, we are going to continue to have to deal with a public health crisis, but at the same time, people are going to go to work, and we are going to need people in these positions. And so now we have a chance to reimagine and redefine what that workplace looks like. And in that regard, there's some opportunity here in the midst of lots of uncertainty.
Globalization of our economy has been one of the major topics of this show since we first started in 2014. It certainly had an enormous impact on the Midwest Heartland region. But I think people woke up to realize during this pandemic especially how dependent we are on supply chains all over the world, including for some of the key drugs. Some of the elements and drugs, we're finding some of the key minerals needed for the production of electronic goods are made mostly in China. Is there going to be, do you see, Bob, a kind of a rethinking of our policy leaders, our elected officials, that, gee, maybe we've overdone this and we need to get those supply chains a little closer to home?
Yeah, well, so you raise... you know, you raise the $60,000 question, and it's a question that gets asked a lot whenever the country goes through traumatic periods. There's speculation upon, well, do we learn our lessons, and do we do something different in the future? Now, I'm not at all confident that we're going to put the genie back in the bottle. I think, the globalization is here to stay. We've actually had globalization since the 1930s. It's taken on different forms, different shapes. So the commitment to the interlocking nature of economies through open trade is here to stay. But I think there are some important lessons that speak to your question, and one is that maybe having following this just-in-time inventory system, where as a way to operate in the leanest possible way, which is really about just squeezing out greater profit for investors in the short term. But instead of having lean inventory, having only the few parts that you need on the shelf for the moment in which you're going to put the order in, believing that you'll always be able to, you know, ramp up as demand increases and you can get the supplies and the parts that you want. Maybe we need to create more security in the system. There should be more room for air. So these inventories should be emboldened. You know, we should look to have a longer supply of the products, the raw materials that we need, so that in the short term, while it may reduce by some, you know, by some rather small degree, the amount of profit that a firm can generate, we keep on the balance sheet a larger supply of products so that you've got some slack in the system, so you have room for some air. So when a crisis hits, and because we have these interlocking logistic systems of trade and where parts are coming from and then assembled, maybe we need to create more slack in the system to allow for trauma and for crisis. And if we did that, then we wouldn't be seeing the kinds of problems in product markets and their impacts on economies, because these supply chains are experiencing all these bottlenecks. And the second thing we can learn from it certainly is that while open trade can be a very good thing, in which all countries can ultimately benefit, and some can specialize more than others in producing certain products, it's not a good idea for any country, not a good idea for the United States, to disinvest in its manufacturing sector, you know, to treat manufacturing as if it's just one other part of the economy, right? We're at historic lows in terms of what percentage of the overall economic wealth is generated that comes from manufacturing in the United States. And if there was a genuine industrial plan to expand that work, then you would be less vulnerable, of course, to these bottlenecks that occur along supply chain. So those are at least two lessons I think could be applied, and we can still be functioning within a global economy in which the U.S. actually can do very well in, and it doesn't have to do so at the expense of so many domestic workers.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and to celebrate Labor Day weekend holiday, I've asked an expert on labor and work in the United States to be our guest today. He's Bob Bruno. He is the director of the Labor Education Program at the University of Illinois Champaign. He's also a professor of labor and employment relations there. And we've just been talking a little bit about the state of the American worker. And your last question segued right into an area I wanted to talk about, is that, you know, the longer I've researched and had guests on and looked at this issue of the revolt of the working class, if that's what you want to call it, in the last 10 years that led, you know, had a major role in electing Donald Trump, especially in the Midwest here, is the role of manufacturing in our economy. It's declined from about a third, you know, of the jobs in the 1970s to maybe under 10% now. And you just see it in all these communities, and I know you're aware of this, throughout the Midwest, the Galesburgs, the Youngstowns, the Janesvilles, that just had this spiral downward. And we were told by politicians from both parties, well, we're just going to, look, we're going to take the factory worker with the high school degree, we're going to retrain you, and you're going to make solar panels, and you're going to be fine. Didn't work out that way, really, for the most part. But I guess my question is this, Bob. I mean, I keep hearing everybody's saying we can't bring manufacturing back. We can't do it. It's not going to be the way it was in the 50s. This is kind of, they say this with a little bit of a sniff and, you know, almost, condescending tone. Why not? I mean, I don't understand that. And I think manufacturing is critical to our security as well, as we saw in World War II. And the key is these jobs pay better. And our economy seemed like it was a lot stronger with a stronger middle class back when manufacturing was at the center of it.
Right. And it's difficult, really, to find any very prosperous, modern economy with a vibrant middle class, with social mobility opportunities to move up the economic ladder. It's difficult to find any nation that's able to achieve that and sustain it without a vibrant manufacturing core of manufacturing jobs. Spin off, if you will, multitudes anywhere from 6, 7, 9, 10 additional jobs. Service sector jobs, while they provide a service and it is a obviously a form of employment, work that needs to be done and does provide work opportunities for millions, at best generates maybe one other job. And as you say, historically, because these have not been service sector positions, retail jobs have not been highly unionized jobs, and unlike manufacturing, which was much heavier at a higher union density, the pay isn't is good. So there's really a lot of good reason to invest in manufacturing. Now, manufacturing can take a lot of forms. There's a lot of technology that can be integrated, into the process, and it might not generate the same number of jobs that it would have done 50 years ago prior to technological efficiencies. And in some areas, like coal mining, the movement away from fossil fuels is going to limit what that growth looks like. But we still need manufactured products. And you could genuinely invest in the training that's required to do those jobs. You can look for ways in which modern technology can help to make the industry more competitive. The thought that you can simply allow manufacturing centers, and as you say, some communities would almost thoroughly or wholly built around an industrial enterprise, to think that you can allow them to disappear and then one by one simply convert all of those workers into some other comparable paying work is just faulty. And it's proven not to be something that you can easily do. But what has to be done is you need to take a very intentional, willful look at industrialization and manufacturing, create a national manufacturing plan, an industrial plan, to invest in the new forms of renewable energy, for example, right? We need to take a look at what the next generation of the production of steel, of electrical components, the manufacturing of automobiles, for example. You can take a very intentional approach, and that's something that the U.S. has been always reluctant to do. That kind of industrial planning, we kind of sit back and allow the marketplace to make decisions, along with government providing some tax incentives. And quite frankly, that's not proven to be a really good defense of the American manufacturing worker.
really can't talk about the state of labor and all, especially in our region here, the Quad Cities, without talking about the state of unions. Unions have a proud history in this region, both Scott and Rock Island counties and the surrounding areas. They've fallen on some hard times and had some major setbacks of late. Mm-hmm. How would you describe the state of unions right now? And are they going to be able to, what do they need to do to adapt and perhaps start growing as a share of the workforce again?
When of course workplaces were traumatized by the pandemic, lots of workplaces closed, but of course, and then lots of workers shifted, those who could, to remote forms of work. But then there were, as you noted earlier, large numbers of essential workers who were directed to report to work, and they found themselves working in difficult circumstances. And lots of healthcare workers, lots of frontline face-to-face workers, workers in the meatpacking industry, workers in manufacturing, found themselves subject to high rates of COVID infections and a disproportional number of deaths, fatalities that occurred as a result of the virus. And those working conditions where a person's very life, right, their actual essence as a human being was put at risk by the marketplace, and the employer hadn't invested in enough protection. The government through OSHA hadn't issued any kind of standards for what the employer needed to do to deal with infectious airborne diseases. So it was, it was really frightening for workers. At the same time, it underscored that workers were vulnerable, and that as an individual worker, you had very little protection because you couldn't choose not to work. You had a family support, you had a mortgage to pay. So you couldn't actually stay home. You didn't have the luxury of working at home or the luxury of taking a leave, some sort of paid leave of absence. And so you're compelled to work, which meant you were compelled to put your life at risk. And interestingly, that did lead to a lot more interest in joining the union. And there is a renewed interest and energy in organizing into a union. And some workers, for example, like nurses who were really exposed to the dangers of COVID, in places where they were unionized, we have seen a real increase in nursing strikes. And in non-union, particularly in hospitals, and then in non-union hospitals, medical facilities, you see a renewed interest amongst those hospital workers to consider joining. Unionization continues. We continue to get a couple of 100,000 of new union members every year, but that's a small number. That's a small number. And when you add in jobs that are lost and the increase of people into the labor market, over the last couple of years, organized labor really hasn't been able to grow its overall size, even though it's showing lots of innovation in new areas, including some real vigorous activity going on at Amazon. Hasn't been successful yet, but something that's occurred, and interest growing in a number of retail areas. So there's dynamism, there's some innovation, but the growth has still been below what it would need to be to really begin to change the balance of power in the labor market. So union density really hasn't gone up the last couple of years. In fact, it's gone down in part because of the Supreme Court's decision in 2018, what is known as the Janus decision, which imposed in the public sector a national right to work regime on public sector workers from coast to coast. And there's a lot of political antagonism towards organized labor. You can see that in states that are governed by Republican governors and legislators. The Republican parties become almost devoutly hostile to organized labor. So it's a very challenging, it's a very difficult environment for organized labor to be operating in. And yet we do see some of these breakouts in new organizing occurring. We've seen a lot of teacher strikes over the last few years. Many of those actually in right-to-work states. We do see manufacturing workers. We see coal miners currently in Alabama on strike. We see here in Illinois, at least in the central part of the state outside of Chicago, the west of Chicago, we see mechanics at dealerships on strike. And they've been out there for a number of weeks. So we have seen, and I think you used the word a little earlier, maybe rebellion or resistance there. There has been a little uptake in that. But the political environment is so hostile that, and labor laws are so weak in terms of protecting workers, that it's a tough hill to climb. And it continues to require lots of innovation, lots of creativity, investing in a lot of organizing, trying to change the political calculus, the impact on free writing policies, impacting organized labor. So it continues to be a really challenging environment.
Well, this was a great discussion, Bob. I appreciate your time. We've run out of time. I had a couple more things, but I guarantee you I'll have you back, and it won't take another as long as it's been since the last time. But my guest today on Heartland Politics has been Bob Bruno, who's the director of the Labor Education Program at the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana, and he's also a professor there of labor and employment relations. Bob, thank you so much for taking the time to be a guest today on Heartland Politics.
Hey, thanks for having me, and it's a real honor to be on the show. I look forward to coming back.
Thank you.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.